Imagine being told that you won't survive without a new heart, or you won't ever see again without new corneas. Imagine knowing that your entire future depends on somebody else donating those organs, but that the chance of that actually happening is extremely slim. That is the reality for thousands of South Africans who find themselves living suspended lives, waiting for an organ that might never come. Around 4,000 people are on the waiting list at any time. Yet less than 1% of South Africans have registered as potential donors. If it was you or your loved one, wouldn't you do anything you could to change those odds? Welcome to A Gift of Life, a podcast series that examines the subject of organ donation in South Africa and asks what we can do to improve the chance of a second chance for those patients. I'm your host, Pippa Hudson, and over the course of this series, I'll be sharing stories of organ and tissue recipients, donors and their families, as well as the doctors, transplant coordinators and other professionals who help turn one family's tragedy into another family's greatest hope. I hope we'll address many of your questions around organ and tissue donation and perhaps inspire you to sign up as a donor yourself. Joining us today is Dr. David Thompson, a critical care specialist and transplant surgeon who works at Groote Schuur Hospital and the University of Cape Town. David completed his undergraduate training at the University of KZN before specializing in surgery at UCT, and he's gone on to subspecialize in critical care. He's been involved in some of the most complex and marathon transplant surgeries ever performed in South Africa. He is a past president and current EXCO member of the SA Transplant Society, and he's even helped to develop national guidelines around organ and tissue donation. David, when did you first start performing transplant surgeries, and what was it that drew you into this field?
I started as a general surgical trainee, and part of my training would be to do a three-month rotation through the transplant unit. And that's when I was first exposed to the actual operations. And then when I completed my training, I stayed on helping in some of the acute care surgical fields and in trauma. But my interest was always in transplantation. And then my career actually pivoted into critical care, where I realized why we weren't busy enough is because of the end of life care aspect and the donor referral process in our systems.
Yeah.
Is where we need to up our game in South Africa and really educate better, put processes in place to quality assure that component of the patient journey in the hospital stay.
Yeah.
So I still help with liver transplants and renal transplants, with a big component in the critical care field where I'm working.
We're going to talk a lot more about the education aspect in a moment, but just to introduce you to our listeners, I know you have been a part of some very complex transplant surgeries with multiple patients involved. I mean, you've performed them, so you've witnessed the process from start to finish from all aspects. What has it been like for you as a surgeon to know you are dealing with patients whose lives could be saved, who are waiting for donor organs that won't be saved in some cases because there is such a shortage and such a low uptake of registration as donors? I'm interested to know how, as a surgeon, you kind of make peace with that, because it must be incredibly frustrating for somebody who has trained and devoted their life to helping to know you could help, but the tools are effectively missing.
I think it shines a spotlight on the scarcity when you're doing the procedure, that you feel a great deal of pressure to use this gift that a grieving family has given or a living donor has given, where they get nothing out of it. There's no more stressful operation than taking an organ from a living donor, and no other surgeons operating on someone who doesn't need the operation for themselves.
Yeah.
So it there's a degree of responsibility, and it's technically very nice surgery on the vascular anastomosis side. But you need to be part of a team, because if the immunology isn't right, the organ's going to reject and not last long enough. And there's layers of complexity to it beyond just the surgery. And it really is a culmination of a lot of medical effort across the board to make it happen.
Yeah.
We are rationing services. We're not able to save everyone across the board in medicine, and we're having to make lots of hard decisions on how best to use scarce resources.
Yeah.
So that is something that I think most clinicians deal with. Transplant does exist in a little bit of a spotlight for that, and I think it's really important that we hold ourselves to the highest standards because of that.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about the process, because I think at least some degree of hesitation in
registering as a donor and making the commitment to say, I would like to be regarded as a donor one day, comes from a place of misconception about what the process actually involves, and comes from myths about what will happen to your body and how it will be treated, and misconceptions. And those might not even be sort of consciously thought about, but they're there. I think for a lot of people at some level, David, there is a fear that, what if I say I'll be an organ donor and they come to harvest and I'm actually still in a point where I might actually recover one day? There's that fear that, what if I jeopardize my own chances? Would you like to speak to this? I mean, there are very, very clearly outlined medical guidelines that would be followed. Would you like to tell us a little bit about them?
There is no conflict of interest. We have very clear legislative guidelines. Mm-hmm. So the doctors certifying the death are not allowed to be involved in the transplant team. And they are doing that two doctors independently of those teams. And I have never recovered and will never recover someone who's not legally certified completely dead mm-hmm. before the process has happened. That doesn't mean that we can't talk about donation at any point in our lives, mm-hmm. and planning away from an acute grieving process is the best way to do it, because that's easier. But ultimately, legislation in South Africa, we will have to get permission from your family who will be just have lost a loved one and in an acute grieving process, yeah. and how well we handle that process as clinicians. And that's not just a reflection on the person making the ultimate request. It's a reflection of that patient's journey through the hospital, how honest the doctors have been with the family throughout about the prognosis, how well they've communicated, mm-hmm. established relationships, established that trust. And I think it's beholden on the clinicians working in ICUs, working in the emergency units to take the time to establish that trust with the patients. It's incredibly hard in busy, overworked units. Mm-hmm. And it's not something we prepare our students well with the requisite skills. We often think communication is just a gift you either have or you don't have, but it very definitely is a skill that can be taught and refined and practiced, especially through simulation type education. And we're seeing a big move at University of Cape Town to expand into that to try and help these education processes.
You've been very actively involved in the course that you developed, an accessible online course. Tell us a little bit more about what that course takes the student, and it's not only for students, it's for professionals as well, isn't it?
It's aimed at the general public, but primarily at medical professionals, nurses, medical undergraduates, and it is a little bit heavy on the medical detail because I think there's security in knowing that medical detail. So people from the lay public who've done the course have come out of it reassured. They might not understand precisely what level of this needs to be in the blood for that to be valid.
Yeah.
But to go through that detail is really important to have the standards. And the course aims to give context because, unfortunately, what's happened historically in South Africa is the transplant teams are the people who've invested the resources in the transplant coordinators to approach families at end of life. Whereas if you want to be able to offer donation to more families, then you need to embed that in all hospitals in their end-of-life care services. And that's a shift that I think we need to make, because even if you look at South African medical schools, if they don't have a transplant surgeon working there, who's championing donation in that curriculum? So I created the course as a tool that doctors could use, and it is getting taken up across universities in South Africa as a tool to educate consistently on the message of brain death and give people context, because no graduate is going to need to know precisely the time limit that a heart has to go into a recipient. Mm-hmm. But it's good to know that context, that there is actually a degree of time pressure to the procedure once the recovery happens. But it's also to focus on the consent issue, yeah. to focus on those issues that you raised earlier about what does the body look like afterwards. If a family asks a question and we can't answer it, then that doesn't inspire confidence. So yeah. that's why it's really important to integrate the transplant team at the right time into the discussions, to prime yourself as the clinician making the referral with the requisite information so that you go into the end-of-life discussions knowing what's possible. Because if we don't know what's possible, then we deny the family that option.
Yeah.
And we mustn't paternalistically decide for our patients and their families. So we must just have a consistent process where we always offer it. That's best practice.
David, you keep on referencing end-of-life care and referring to one imagines a patient who's been suffering from a long-term illness or has been in hospital for an extended stay. I think perhaps it's worth just pointing out here, there are very specific conditions in which one can become an organ donor. Even, you know, if somebody is, for example, killed in a motor accident, are the chances there that they, even if they had registered as a donor, could actually be one? Or are there very specific medical criteria within which death has to occur to make it possible?
So for organ donation, there has to be a mechanical ventilator involved in your patient trajectory in the hospital. Whether you're certified brain dead on the ventilator or the ventilator is removed because of futility and you would be expected to pass away from circulatory arrest. Those are the only contexts where organ donation is possible. Tissue donation is possible in many more circumstances because it's not dependent on that level of care being delivered to the patient. Someone can die at home and there's enough time to recover tissues. Organs have this time pressure, so that's why it has to be in such a controlled hospital environment. But unnatural deaths, it's a common misperception, and we even encounter it in the medical professionals, is not a contraindication to be a donor. A traumatic brain injury is often a cause of brain death, and we routinely request consent, we have to, by the legislation, from the forensic pathologist. So the surgeon would write a report on the condition of the organs, and the body would proceed for a legally required post-mortem afterwards, and we need the forensic pathologist's permission before. If you look at the permissions we need to do a donor, it's from the head of the medical institution. It's from the family, and it's from the forensic pathologist in the cases of an unnatural death where the doctor's not able to fill in the death certificate.
Right. So, I mean, it's an extensive system of checks and balances that you're describing there, David, to ensure that this is fully consented to. And I'm hearing, sort of underlying all of your answers, an immense sense of appreciation of the dignity of preserving the dignity of the donor through this process. Again, looping back to, I think, that thing people fear of what will happen to my body. How will I be treated in aware of the time limit? Will there be a rush to retrieve the organs and at the expense of my dignity? Would you like to offer some reassurance? I mean, you've been involved in this process firsthand.
So the recovery operation, and I dislike the word harvest, it implies something that's not actually what's happening. It's a very dignified operation to recover the organs. It's very controlled. We actually have a donor pause right before the surgical incision is made, where the entire theater staff pauses for a minute in respect of the patient and their grieving family that has given permission for it to happen. So it is a very dignified procedure. The body is reconstructed afterwards. In those cases of unnatural death, it proceeds for a forensic pathology investigation anyway that would make the same incisions. So we stitch the body, repair it completely, and there's a report written about the organs for the state pathologist. In the cases of tissue donation, they do exactly the same. They reconstruct an open casket funeral as possible. It's a very dignified process from start to finish.
David, let's talk a little bit about the next step in the process then. Every transplant operation is going to be different based on the circumstances and the organ that is being transplanted. But in general, I think as the public, we often hear of the laborious nature, the length and duration of these surgeries, that we often hear stories of surgeons operating for 12, 14, 16 hours in a go. What is it that is so complex other than the extraordinary feat of taking an organ from one body and allowing it to function in a new body, a miracle of science it is. Do you want to just elaborate a little bit more about the complexity of the second operation that follows?
So if you think about the number of operations, there's a donor operation that happens with a thoracic team, an abdominal team, a tissue recovery team, and the recipient operations would be timed to start at various points while that operation is underway. So there's lots of logistical considerations that would be happening potentially at multiple institutions, potentially across the country. And so that's the first operation. Then with the organ being transported off into that second, the various recipients operations undertaking, that team's responsible for, in the cases of heart, lung, and liver, of removing those organs. Kidneys are actually applied onto your external iliac vessels in the groin area. So you don't have to remove the native kidney for a deceased donor transplant. It's an additional kidney. That's nice and close in position to the bladder. So technically, that's a more forgiving space to work. And those patients are stable on dialysis. So actually, they're already supported through their complete lack of having functioning kidneys.
Yes.
Heart, lung, and liver are a completely different story. You have to have those organs to live. And obviously, there's a timing component. We can support people under anesthesia, and it's really important to have a high-quality theater team, anesthetic team. The heart and the lungs are going on to either ECMO or bypass, and keeping someone alive with no liver, you have no clotting factors. You're going to start to bleed with no liver because all those clotting factors come from your liver. So it really is a big team effort to do that. It gets complicated when things start to bleed, if there's technical aspects that need to be revisited. But the teams are highly trained and very senior people every time performing these procedures. Right. But that's a huge team effort. And yeah, it can take varied amount of times. If you look at the timing from a deceased donor, the kidney people, because the kidneys can stay in the ice longer, they only get theater time later. They're not generally prioritized. Heart has to go in as soon as possible. It's the most sensitive organ. So they are actually in bed before the kidney surgeons are probably finished. And then the liver and lung, depending on the complexity of the explant and the unwellness of the patient, those two take quite a long time. But practice makes perfect, and you want your transplants to be done in high volume centers. And that's why it's really important that we try and scale up our transplant activity, because that links to good patient outcomes, to have these centers of expertise. And then we need to disseminate those centers of expertise from there to improve patients' access to transplant.
I mean, I've had many conversations with surgeons who've gone overseas to train in facilities in Sydney and Canada, etc., and bring those skills back to South Africa, for which we're immensely grateful. But as you say, the more that are done, the more people are trained in the skills, the better our capacity to offer them becomes. What are some of the challenges preventing us from doing more of them? I mean, this is South Africa. We have a history of transplantation. We were the place where the first heart transplant was conducted. We know that one of the big stumbling blocks is the availability of donors and donor organs. Is the rest to do with funding? What are the other challenges that prevent us from doing more of them?
Financial is a concern. It is an expensive procedure, so you are competing against other service offerings in the healthcare sector. Ultimately, you have a very powerful story at the end for someone who in all likelihood would be dead without the procedure, and you've taken a family's tragedy and turned it into a medical success. And that is very powerful for the system to do. There are lots of trickle-down effects in terms of, if I think of our lung transplant program at Groote Schuur, it's led to the development of an ECMO service that then benefits all patients who need ECMO in the ICU. So there's a big trickle-down effect that's very positive from it, but it does exist at the top of a functioning health ecosystem. You can't have that apex predator at the top of an ecosystem if you don't have the grassland supporting the antelope. So I really feel that donation suffers a little bit because we are offering end-of-life care in such pressured situations, and we need to take the time to do that well. And then we'll have more donors as a result of that intervention. I think we need to make systemic changes in our system and mandating a discussion when certain clinical triggers are met at the end of life, either for referral to palliative care services or to the donation team, or the transplant team, or integration, is really important. But it's amazing how families and doctors don't want to engage with that reality soon enough. There are systems you can put in place. The UK's done that to make mandated triggers where those discussions should be had and documented. And then you can quality assure that process. Was all the family members spoken to? Did they have enough time to be spoken to? And then you do right by the patient and the family.
As you said, the last thing you want is to be approaching this for the first time when somebody is facing the loss of their loved one in that acute grief state. If you've had that conversation sooner, you've had the frank answered their questions, prepared them for the conversation, you've sort of smoothed the way. Dave, obviously you are doing what you can to help medical professionals approach those conversations with better communication, with compassion, with dignity, and hopefully achieve better outcomes from them. What else would you like to see change in our landscape to help boost the number of donor registrations? What else can be done?
So I think having more discussion about it. I've often wondered on the radio, you always present those oil barrel prices.
Yes.
For the month of August, could we just present the number of patients waiting on the waiting list in South Africa? I think that would be a more powerful message to consistently get out there than the oil barrel prices. I'm not sure who that's consistently relevant for. But it is an awareness issue and a discussing, because if you're primed, then the discussion becomes easier. Mm. If you've been primed away from that grieving process to think about it or consider it, if you think about the request, you would always ask it of the family in terms of what would this patient have wanted? And they're the surrogate decision maker for that patient's wishes at that point if they'd reached that situation. And that makes it an easier thing for the family to duly consider. Mm. And you want it to be an informed discussion. And I think there's a very definite art to keeping the discussion going with a grieving family so that they have that time to have all their questions answered. Often we just say no, and culture and religion get used as a method to shut down the discussion before there can be a proper discussion and actually a truly informed decision to be made. So the coordinators perform an exemplary job of trying to do that in a very challenging situation. And I think we need to support them more as the clinicians making the referrals. Mm. And the success rate of consents is very definitely a reflection of those clinicians referring as well and how they've handled the lead up to the process.
Yeah.
And there's no quick suss out of the family for their views of organ donation earlier in the process. And you mentioned the trust issue. And so it's really important to decouple prognostic discussions from an organ donation request. And the right time to be asking would be when the families fully come to terms with the situation and the prognosis, and then they start to ask what next, rather than us to force the what next onto the family, who may, different family members may be at completely various grieving points in terms of where their headspace is at.
My final question then, David, is going back to the discussion of the online course that you've developed to try and help move this process forward and increase the awareness and the education. You did mention it's available to the general public and not just to medical students and doctors. If somebody listening to this conversation would like to take a look at it, where do they go to find it?
So if you just Google organ donation from death to life, it's a UCT created course and it's hosted on a platform called Coursera. And if you register for financial aid, it's completely free. And all they do is check whether your IP address comes from a developing world country. Their business model is to ask if you'd like to pay for a certificate, but actually it's completely free. I'm very open with all my creations of education resources. So it's a very nice platform to use and the content is very good. It's well delivered that way. So they're more than welcome. It runs every week automatically. The assessment mechanism is built in automatically, so it's really a powerful tool to help educate and let yourself feel that you've learned something out of the deal at the end of it.
Well, we've learned a great deal today. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, David.
Thank you for listening to this episode of A Gift of Life. Please check out our website, capetalk.co.za, to follow the series in full and make sure you don't miss an episode. And I'd really like to encourage you to share these episodes with your own family and friends. Help start the conversation about organ donation in your circles of influence. If you'd like to register as a donor, please visit the Organ Donor Foundation on www.odf.org.za. It's a quick, easy, and free process, and it could save 7 lives.